Joined now on Zoom by food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. I want you to know, Corby, I renewed my subscription to the Atlantic yesterday, so I'm feeling pretty good. Good to see you.
It's invaluable. We all need the Atlantic.
It is
fabulous. It's really cheap, too. I forget how much, because I have one, too.
$54.95.
Don't let work get around.
I thought it was less than that. Okay. So, Corby Kummer, eggs are still really expensive for individuals, but they're really causing a problem for a lot of restaurants and small diners. What's going on?
You know, all of us can decide we're going to have, fewer scrambled eggs this week. Restaurants and diners can't. And one restaurant was quoted talking about the next big St. Patrick's Day celebration. And I have a heartless reading of this story, which is about the 68% rise in egg prices. Is it from the beginning of this year? This year, 68%, 2 months rise in egg prices, which is, I'm looking for pain points for the current Trump administration policies to hit, and for regular consumers to get angry and involved. But that's only my personal prejudice. It's very bad for business owners who are relying on serving eggs to figure out how are they going to afford these. And so it's about, diners and small people.
And small bakers, bakeries. I mean, bakeries are getting murdered by, killed by this thing too, right?
And all of the big Sodexo and Cisco and all the big food makers and food suppliers.
But in fairness, the Trump administration, which I'm no fan of, what can they do about bird flu? Bird flu's the real reason, right?
Stop disguising data about how far it's spreading. Stop defunding vaccines and remedial strategies that were already in the works about avian flu. Public health officials are just waiting. For example, have you heard about or do you read much about the measles outbreak in Texas?
Yes, right.
Unvaccinated Mennonites. And 22% of those children are hospitalized, which is huge. So, but the Trump administration won't allow the CDC to have daily calls about it. Same thing with bird flu. It's very hard to understand the extent of this. But it is easy to understand that public health funding is being cut that was trying to prevent spread of outbreaks.
Huh. Is part of this the way the birds are kept? I mean, we have the free-range, pasture-raised eggs option. They're more expensive, the pasture-raised particularly. But is that part of the problem? Would it matter if they were raised in less crowded circumstances?
It would.
It would.
More exposure to air. I have to say I'm not a bird farmer, but I know that some of the way it's spread is like Canadian geese and other birds droppings.
Yeah.
Over, so if an animal is in the outdoors and pasture raised, that's one way it's spread. But the fact of the crowded conditions enormously stresses the animals.
Yeah.
Leaves them more vulnerable to infection and makes it much easier for infection to spread.
You know what stresses me? When you called them Canadian geese rather than Canada geese, what stresses me, Corby Kummer. It is Canada geese, is it not?
Big deal.
That's a cute.
I won't make this mistake again.
I should hope.
Corby,
can we get, let's not leave this yet. Is there an expectation in the food world about, assuming that the vast majority of the reason, as Marjorie says, for the cost increase is the bird flu, is there a view that by April, by next June, but is there a view as to when this thing comes to a head and prices start coming down, or is it just hold your breath?
None at all, because there's apparently no, a USDA spokesperson who's quoted, which already is shocking, because they've clamped down on the USDA, says no relief before June. Wow. It's going to keep going. So no, it's just been spreading like wildfire and like viruses spread in flocks. So I don't think there is an end in sight.
By the way, I don't know if we mentioned this on the air, and we should have, because since Corby mentioned vaccines a couple of times, I assume people know that Robert Kennedy, in one of his first acts as head of HHS, was to postpone the scheduled meeting, I think for this week, of the Vaccine Advisory Board, which has some of the most eminent scholars and practitioners on vaccines.
It's called ACIP.
What's it called?
And every day there's a new outrage. And on Friday with CDC, it was postponing of ACIP. It was a meeting of ACIP that approved all of the COVID vaccine formulations. It had to approve them beforehand. They are international experts.
Talking to Corby Kummer.
So, you know, I just, this bears repeating because there was a story in the Globe last week. I just couldn't believe it, that this woman who was a stay-at-home mom got a little kid, says she wasn't going to vaccinate anybody anymore because she got the COVID vaccine and then she got COVID. And I thought, okay, it was supposed to make it less horrible if you got COVID. I mean, most of us who got COVID got it after you were vaccinated, but you didn't get very sick because you've been vaccinated. But that's what she said. And she's got a child that she's not going to vaccinate now for childhood diseases like measles, mumps, and rubella. I mean,
what people can't differentiate is between the devastation on a child's immune system and the permanent damage that measles, mumps, and rubella can cause a child, as opposed to the fairly temporary, we hope, problems and discomfort that COVID or other things that adults are vaccinated cause adults. It's deadly for children.
Yeah.
Measles especially. And there haven't been worse measles outbreaks in 30 years.
Okay. There is this effort to ban sugary drinks, candy, and all this kind of stuff from SNAP benefits. That's for people that need extra money to buy food. Robert F. Kennedy, of course, he is the new newly confirmed Health and Human Services Secretary. But this apparently is not even under him. It's under the USDA.
If you've been listening to me drone on this show about how RFK Jr. has no power over school lunch, none, it's USDA. The interesting thing in the news story from, I think, AP is that Brooke Rollins, the new Secretary of Agriculture, was saying, I look forward to working with Senator Kennedy on these restrictions. And I would say only she has the power, but it isn't even really she who has all the power. It's state by state. And how they enact and how they put regulations on SNAP. Congress passed a law. Congress has to reenact and rewrite a law that has said no food is bad, no food is forbidden for SNAP, and we're not going to, you know, under the influence of food manufacturers, we're not going to say any food is illegal or outlawed in SNAP. It would have to be Congress itself redoing a law saying no sugary beverages or no candy or no junk. That's exceedingly unlikely.
Because of the food lobbies.
Because of the food lobbies, and also because advocates for underserved and poor people point to a number of really interesting facts, which are that non-SNAP recipients buy just as much soda as SNAP recipients. So why are you stigmatizing people who get SNAP and saying, you can't have this food because we think you're unhealthy and bad? It's just a way of restricting their freedom. And this has been a really tortured issue for years. But in 2007, a bunch of state waivers failed. It's just not going to happen.
I'm so glad you said what you said about their freedom. I mean, a lot of people say, yeah, well, the difference is that they're spending my tax dollars to buy food. And my response to that, I'm totally with Corby on this. My response is, if processed foods and sweet drinks and candy are so horrible that people on food stamps shouldn't be allowed to purchase them, then we should ban them so that nobody can purchase them, not just poor people. You can't have one without the other. And this discrimination against low-income people who have to depend upon government funds to eat is ridiculous, particularly in light of the fact that all the research shows, and I'm sure you could bear this out, the vast majority of what they spend is not frivolously on crap. It's on basics to keep their families fed. Speaking of it, though, there is a great line. There's a Vanity Fair story about one of Trump's guys, Boris Epstein, I think is how you pronounce his name. And in the middle of this thing, Zoe pointed this out to, I love this. Behind his, this has nothing to do with the story. Behind his desk, Trump's mood is buoyant. He yells, bring me the poison. His basket of Starburst, Hershey miniatures, Laffy Taffy, and Tootsie Rolls instantly appears, quote, okay, get the poison out of here, he says, taking two handfuls. I don't know why that amuses me so much, but it's a great little image. Barack Obama's eaten six almonds. Of course, that was allegedly a made-up story or whatever he ate, and he's grabbing two fulls of candy. On this one, I'm with Trump.
No, it's a fabulous story because it's the constant hypocrisy of do as the doctor says, not as the doctor does. But also something I want to point out is Michael Wolff, author of this story, is the national Trump authority and whisperer. You know, Maggie Haberman has fabulous sources. Michael Wolff, I would argue, has even better sources. So this is a very long story. Vanity Fair is smart to be paying him, I'm sure, a fortune for these stories. But it was a delicious detail. And, of course, he's a huge junk food advocate. So what
delicious
is
detail. Beautifully put there, Corby Cummer. Thank you very much.
We always talk about that Trump eats every all these bad things. But you got to say, for a 78-year-old guy, he certainly seems to be full of vim and vigor. He doesn't look any worse for the wear, Corby.
I'm resisting adding anything to that comment, except everyone's metabolism and genetics are different.
Okay.
By the way, a huge part of Nikki Glaser's act last night at the Wang was about Trump's spray tan, but unfortunately none of it is repeatable. It's a shame you missed it. We're talking to Corby Cummer. So there is such a thing as a French fry cartel.
Yes.
Where apparently I don't know if it's surreptitious at all. I shouldn't have said that. They are circumventing antitrust laws by doing something that allows all the major manufacturers of frozen French fries to essentially manipulate the price. Did I get that right, Corby?
I love this story and feel really bad that I don't know about it, because I do know about how I think it's a big four potato companies have been controlling the price of potatoes for decades in this country. But here it's such an easy loophole. All of the companies subscribe to the same software that tells them when and how to price their potatoes. And if they're all using the same software and acting on the same recommendations, that's price fixing. And is somebody going to call them on it, like the government? And there was a surprising, the government is saying, this is bad. I cannot believe that the current government would prosecute them for this. But it extends to other kinds of recommendation software, a commercial real estate software called RealPage, which tells landlords how much they should be charging at what point for rents. The minute you read it, you think this makes complete intuitive sense. It leads to price fixing, but companies say, we need the best data and we want to act on the best recommendations because, you know, what do we personally do with our finances? We have enormous funds that are relying on the same places for recommendations on how we invest our money.
You know what?
That's what huge companies do.
What's interesting about, I'm embarrassed to say, I don't know, where does this story come from? What's the source of this thing? Vox. The interesting thing, and I think they're right about this, is if the same four biggest French fry manufacturers or the biggest landlords met in a room and agreed to set their prices, they'd be clearly in violation of law. But because they're doing it through this software to which they all subscribe, technically, I guess they could argue that they weren't violating the law, which is sad, is what the
bottom
line.
It's so great. But, you know, except under Elon Musk's rules, nobody meets in rooms anymore anyway.
That's a very fine point. We're talking to Corby Cummer, our food guy.
So Jim mentioned earlier in the show, a lot of the farmers in big farming states are Trump people. They supported him. But there's some issues they're facing. Tariffs, a funding freeze on some of the food they've already produced and hope to sell. So where are the farmers of America on the new presidency?
They're confused. And again, my heartless, maybe egg prices are going to mobilize the public against the administration. Farmers are already saying, it's spring. We were promised money. There's a related and really salient story about USDA climate smart policies, a huge thing under Secretary Tom Vilsack for the last 4 years and the 8 years previously when he was a Secretary of Agriculture under Trump. He was enacting all kinds of help for small farms, especially to mitigate the effects of rainfall, of what's now politically, euphemistically called weather-related emergencies, because you can't call it climate change. All of this money has been frozen. Farmers have bought lambs that are about to give birth. They've installed fences. They've started spending the money they were promised by the USDA. They can't lose this moment in time because it's spring when they have to get ready to plant and they have to put these remediation affects and actually machinery and infrastructure improvements on their own farm. I also have to read a quotation, and then I'll tell you why. With this uncertainty, they're pulling out of farmers' markets. These are farmers canceling contracts because they don't think they're going to have the capacity to meet them, said Vanessa Garcia-Polanco, Government Relations Director for the National Farmers Coalition, Young Farmers Coalition. When funding is frozen, it sends a signal their business plan is not safe. She's a Food Leaders Fellow at Food and Society at the Aspen Institute. And she's fantastic, and I was so glad that the Associated Press found her to quote. But what it's pointing out is the uncertainty in the business climate of all of these freezes that begin, then they end, then they're lifted, then they start again. Complete uncertainty and chaos for farmers. What a related Washington Post story that you were talking about, Marjorie, said was they're looking at possibly very bad business repercussions from tariffs. But I don't think it went into if mass deportations begin, they lose their labor and they lose their ability to harvest.
Well, can I tell you, though, this is purely anecdotal, but from responsible reporters, so I assume it represents the reality, is when I've seen farmers interviewed almost anywhere who are Trump supporters, whether it's on CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, who are saying we're suffering because of the freeze of funds, we're suffering because of the tariffs, or worried about potential future tariffs and whatever. What was the third thing you mentioned a second ago that's having an impact on farmers?
Deportation of labor.
Oh, the mass deportation. Some of them. There was one that I'll never forget. A cattle farmer, and I can't remember which, maybe Iowa, on CNN, who said he'd be out of business if there were mass deportations.
Right.
Virtually every single one of them has said they continue to support Trump, despite the fact that his policies could destroy their business, which is just, it's really, and by the way, these were not uninformed people. These were not people that you and I talk about all the time, Marjorie, who don't even know that X is happening or believe the wrong thing. They understand the Trump policies. They understand the damage they are and can be doing, and yet they're standing by their man, which is rather an incredible phenomenon in American politics.
When you say
politics.
They don't know, I want to go back to the point about SNAP recipients. SNAP recipients know perfectly what's healthy and what's unhealthy. They're not buying soda ignorantly. They're buying it because it fills their kids' bellies for very little money, or they themselves like it. They can tell you what's healthy and not. So in any case, these Trump supporters continue to say they support him. They'll vote into their own graves.
So, Corby, we only have a couple of minutes left, but can you tell us quickly about this pastry shop up in New Hampshire that's in this free speech controversy?
I love this story.
This is supposed to be the live free or die state, right? I don't understand how there's this, fabulous huge mural above a donut bakery that has sunny, lovely, tempting pictures of donuts and muffins. And New Hampshire is saying, this is a big public sign. It qualifies as advertising. And it was authorized by, I can't remember why, what is the state law that allowed it? But it's polluting the town as an advertisement. And so because it depicts goods that are being sold and the very building when it appears over, it's got to come down. Because it's not art, it's advertising.
And by the way, didn't high school students do it or something? It's like an art project.
It's a wonderful story. Strawberry
that has donuts. And by the way,
pie.
I for one can say there is nothing that suggests art more to me than a couple of donuts. Would you not? Well, Corby probably wouldn't agree.
Listen, if you get muffins and cinnamon buns into it, as they do, I will go along with it.
Yeah, it does seem odd, doesn't it?
We're going to follow this case. And Corby, I didn't even thought of Corby's point. It is the live free or die
That's
state.
Right.
So why are they cracking down?
And the Virginia-based Institute for Justice is representing Sean Young of Levitt's Country Bakery, which illustrates this. And Virginia government officials don't get to tell people, including entrepreneurs and businesses, what they can and can't pay. It's New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Why are they telling people what they can and can't pay?
Do you have an answer for this, Jim?
No, I do not.
Okay.
But I would like a donut, actually. Sooner the better. Good to see you, Corby Cummer.
And you.
Corby Cummer, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Corby Kummer. He's our food analyst guy. He joins us every week, and we're very glad he does. Corby Kummer, we should say, is a executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Up next, we have just enough time for two more things. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews.